Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Collins Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo. In photographic and video images broadcast to the world, an August 21st attack in Syria, allegedly using chemical weapons, came to light. The world response has been condemnation of the attack, but no immediate military action. The U.S. response now rests in the hands of Congress, as the Obama administration makes its case for directed military strikes within Syria. Questions linger, though, as to who perpetrated the attack, and we await the analysis of samples collected from the site of the attack by the United Nations Chemical Weapons Inspection Team. Would a military strike by the U.S., congressionally authorized or not, solve or exacerbate humanitarian concerns and atrocities in Syria? Can we come to a consensus about what to do? Joining me in the studio to discuss these issues is the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and a political science professor at the University of New Mexico, Dr. Mark Pisani. Joining me by phone is Dr. Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the Middle Eastern Studies Program. Dr. Zunis also chairs the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Welcome to both of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to be here.
Good morning, Dr. Zunis. Joining us later by phone from Oakland, California, will be Jacqueline Cabasso, Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation. Dr. Zunis, let's start with you this morning. Why is the situation in Syria so complex, and why are so many calling for a measured, cautious response, if any, to the August 21st attacks?
Part of the problem is that despite the horrific repression of the Assad regime, even prior to the chemical weapons attack, is that they've built up a pretty strong base of support by manipulating the large minority populations there to their side, by the crony capitalist system they've developed of business interests with close ties to the regime. The party apparatus and the military are very widespread and longstanding, going back many decades, but primarily by waving the nationalist card. That's that they've had a really rough history in terms of colonialism, in terms of foreign intervention. They see themselves as sort of the last bastion of secular Arab nationalism, fighting off both Islamist extremism and Western imperialism. And so, one of the big problems, I think, among many of a foreign intervention by the United States and then possibly France as well, but that it would, whatever physical damage they might do in terms of the strategic assets of the Syrian government, it would end up strengthening the regime politically.
Now, you wrote an article, it was published yesterday on truthout.org, 8 arguments against going to war with Syria, top talking points that should be raised with Congress as to why authorizing strikes against Syria or upon Syria would be a bad idea. How do you or how should we rank the importance of those points you raised, Dr. Zunis?
The main thing I would press is that I can't really think of a strategic logic of what these bombings would do. I mean, yes, there's the question of the legality of the operation. There's the fact the United States is not in a very good position, morally in a very good position, given our inconsistency on international law and on chemical weapons proliferation, a whole number of issues, but what it really comes down to is, I think the humanitarian impulse is a real one, that, oh, my God, there are terrible things happening, you've got to do something, is that there's not a lot practically that can really work. I've looked at all the various military scenarios, and, if I really thought that they would do any good, it would lessen the suffering of the Syrian people, if it would reduce the likelihood chemical weapons would be used again, if it would help towards a democratic transition in that country, or any of those things, I'd say, okay, let's put aside these other issues and let's do it anyway. But quite frankly, I really have had, as much as I've tried, I have not been able to find any convincing argument that it's going to do anything but maybe blow up a few things, kill some people. But the suffering, the fighting, et cetera, will continue.
Okay. Thank you for those responses. And we'll dig into the legal issues when we get Jackie Cabasso on the phone from the Western States Legal Foundation in a bit. Dean Pisani, we spoke briefly yesterday, and you remarked to me that the events in the U.S. over the last week are as fascinating as what has happened in Syria has been tragic. Why do you note that?
Well, I've noticed a lot of people talking about this emphasize the similarities between the Syrian case and the Iraqi case of a decade ago. But for me, what is most interesting is that my sense is that the Obama administration, or at least the president, is willing to take no for an answer. And I don't know that for sure because I don't know what's going inside the president's head right now, but he was on the verge of making a strike and then decided to send it to Congress, knowing that it's been difficult for him to get anything from the Republican House of Representatives at all on any dimension. And there haven't been a lot of foreign policy issues that have been a part of the debate between the Republican House and the administration, but he had to know that bringing it to Congress raised the possibility that Congress would say no.
You know, and when I looked at it, I thought about the political, you know, implications involving Congress, so he doesn't have to go it alone. But, you know, he's also a lame duck president. He's in his second term. So what can we make of erasing that from the equation, at least as far as Obama's concerned?
Well, I think that in part it means that he has less of a concern about being called a wimp for not acting. And it's sad that it often comes down to something that crass. But to some extent, some of the arguments for why the U.S. should intervene is that the president drew a line in the sand.
He called it the red line.
The red line. Right. A red line in the sand, to mix metaphors. So he drew a red line in the sand, and it appears that the Syrian government stepped over that line. And if the president doesn't do something about that, then he will lose credibility. The more pejorative way of saying that is, you know, he'll look like a wimp. Everyone will take advantage of them. No one will take the president or the United States seriously. If he wants to serve, if he wants to be reelected for a second term, he has to take that into consideration more seriously than if he doesn't have to stand for election again. So he has the opportunity to be somewhat more patient and create the possibility that Congress will say no, and then he can say, we will not respond. No. So I think I'm guessing, and I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing that he's at least opening the possibility that he doesn't have to respond.
Okay.
Because I imagine that he's doing the same strategic calculations that Dr. Zunis has been doing and seeing that there are a variety of ways in which making a pinprick attack could make things worse, and no clear way in which they advance anyone's strategic agenda in Syria.
Now, you have studied and written about civil wars in the U.S. in other countries and the U.S. intervention into them. Aside from this unusual step of seeking congressional approval, is this buildup following any familiar pattern, or is there something different about it?
Well, the familiar pattern would usually be that a president would try to bludgeon Congress into saying yes, or if they thought Congress could say no, they wouldn't bring it before Congress, and they would use the executive power and claim that the War Powers Act doesn't apply and that they have the authority to launch this kind of strike. And so the standard practice has been to say that we don't have to ask permission for something like this, and we will not. Or to ask for authorization only if they're sure that Congress will say yes. So that's why the possibility of a no is something that makes this stand apart from the practice in the not-too-distant past.
Dr. Zunis, I'm curious, do you still see the possibility of a no, and do you see that having any impact on the action that the U.S. eventually takes?
There's a possibility of a no. The vote count at this point is well short of a majority for authorizing the use of force. Though the largest block of members of Congress are in the undecided category at the moment. Most of them are hearing from constituents saying, please do not go to war, do not support this. And that can indeed have an impact. At the same time, there's this argument that the prestige of the United States is at stake can be a powerful one. I noticed in the hearings a couple of days ago, it seemed like a lot of the questions were about Iran. It kind of reminded me of whenever there are hearings about Central America or Southern Africa or Vietnam, everybody'd be talking about the Soviets, you know, like as if that was the issue. But so there's a big push on a whole number of levels. The Secretary of State and Vice President in particular have been pushing this issue, and we have Nancy Pelosi, normally one of the more liberal members of Congress, in her role as Democratic leader. She's twisting a lot of arms of more progressive members to support the President on this one. So my guess is that when the final vote comes, it will be to authorize the use of force.
You know, just to note one thing I read about this morning, that the Russians are sending a delegation to lobby Congress. That's got to make things a little different than some of our past conflicts, I would imagine. We want to bring in a caller now. It's Joel Gallegos from the Answer Coalition, and he wants to tell us about an event. Good morning, Joel. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm just calling to let people know that tomorrow in front of the UNM bookstore at 5 o'clock, there's going to be a demonstration in regards to aggressions on Syria. We're calling on Congress to vote no unequivocally. We believe that there's no good to come out of any sort of military aggression against Syria. And also, this is going to be in coordination with much larger actions going on Saturday across the country as organized by the Answer Coalition. And we hope that everybody can make it out there. And, you know, we're really glad that you all are having the call-in show in which individuals can express their concerns over these issues.
Well, Joel, tell us one more time, if you would, please, where and when you will be gathering.
Yes, it's going to be tomorrow, Friday, at 5 o'clock in front of the UNM bookstore.
And what is the general message of the rally?
The general message is going to be to tell Congress to vote no. We've already gotten the support of Senator Tom Udall, who voted against the proposal. We'd like to see more of that, and we'd like to let our representatives know that people in New Mexico are absolutely against this war, and we can see it in the polls nationally, in which there's increasingly more and more people who are opposed to it. And I feel that if they're going to represent us, then they need to do that. And it needs to be reflect the will of the people.
All right, Joel, thanks so much for your call this morning and for the information you imparted. And we do want to note that one of our New Mexico senators who was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Tom Udall, did vote no against the Senate resolution. He was one of seven who voted no, and there was another Democratic senator who voted present. And so just interesting goings on there as Senate as well. We're talking this morning about the issues in Syria. What to do? Can we get some consensus? If you would like to join in our discussion today, there are several ways for you to participate. You may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Callin Show webpage at kunm.org. You may call our local number, 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. Or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866. With questions and comments, we want to know, what do you think the U.S. response to what happened in Syria should be? We'll take a short break. We'll be joined again by Dean Pisani from the University of New Mexico and Dr. Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco.
The Voting Rights Act took a hit this year by the United States Supreme Court. People are concerned the changes to the state's voting laws may negatively impact Native communities. What does the change to the Voting Rights Act mean for Native voters? Join us as we talk about voting rights and Native America on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and I'm joined in the studio today by Dr. Mark Pisany. He is the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences here at UNM and a political science professor. Joining me by phone is Dr. Stephen Zunis. He is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the Middle Eastern Studies program. You're welcome to join in our discussion. Let's bring in Glenn from Jemez Springs, who wants us to look at past wars. Good morning, Glenn. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Very timely. I have the Quaker sign in my front yard. War is not the answer. I just came back from Palestine, Israel, with Christian Peacemakers team in March. I have friends up here in Jemez Springs who are both Vietnam and Afghan, Iraq, PTSD former soldiers, and I tend to go, no war, please. But then I met this man, William, at our Bodhimanda Zen Center here a couple of weeks ago. He's a U.S. citizen, but he's lived in Japan for many years. And he said, okay, Glenn, you don't want the war, think about this. And he said, it's his understanding that had we not done what we did, that I disagree with the bombs in Japan, he said they would have kept fighting till every last Japanese man was dead. And then he said, Germany, he said, I'm a gay person, and look what would have continued to happen with killing more and more millions of people in Germany had we not intervened. And finally, he said, think about our own history, the French helping us fight off the Brits. And I think, for me, this is almost a classic sign of ambivalence. You're torn both ways. I don't want the war. I saw what Bush did with Iraq. And yet, good Lord, how many more millions of Syrians have to be displaced and ruined and all of that? So I guess I just pray about it and hope the best decision is made, whatever it is. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, Glenn. Any mm-hmm. comment? Any comment, Dean?
I can.
Go ahead, Dr. Zunis. Please do.
Just that's actually ahistorical. The Japanese had made peace overtures. The declassified documents that indicated that they were ready to surrender, that the bombings were necessary, as largely a challenge to the Soviet Union that had recently joined the war and was advancing through Manchuria and down the Korean Peninsula. And if you look at our own Revolutionary War, it was the nonviolent resistance that had been going on for many years prior to 1775 that had substantially weakened the British rule. They were unable, and the taking of arms actually set things back. But going more to the present situation, empirical evidence has shown that whenever there's foreign intervention in a civil war, it actually increases the killing in the short term and only decreases it in the long term if it's neutral. Similarly, it tends to make the fighting go longer. And the reasons are pretty obvious. The government feels, okay, we have nothing to lose now. We're taking the gloves off completely. And the rebels think, oh, we got foreign support now, so we don't need to compromise. We don't need to compromise. We can just keep on fighting.
Whoop, we've lost you now, Dr. Zunis.
I'm sorry. We can keep on fighting. And the bloodshed just gets even worse. I mean, if you look at a situation like Kosovo, the rebels. The Serbs are doing some terrible things, but the wholesale ethnic cleansing did not start until after the bombing began. So I really don't buy this argument that simply by going to war that we're going to make things better.
All right, let's have you weigh in.
Well, I think that one of the most troubling aspects of this and why it's such a difficult choice is that if there is no international intervention to try to end the war, and there are a variety of ways that could be pursued, many of them are unlikely to be successful. But if there is no effort, the likely outcome is a continuation of the stalemate. It's a stalemate that has killed 100,000 people now and is likely to continue to kill people. So do nothing, the war continues, people continue to die. Do a variety of potential responses, and the war could very well continue. It could intensify. And so to some extent, if you do nothing, you're somewhat culpable with the continuation of the killing. If you do something, you could be directly culpable. And if for no other reason that in a lot of the wars that Stephen was talking about, there are unintended consequences of intervention.
No, but what about the argument that it's an internal Syrian issue, and who are we to say what needs to happen there?
Well, part of the stalemate has been generated by international intervention on behalf of the combatants. So there's a lot of support that does come from Iran, that comes from Russia, that comes from a variety of sources for the Syrian government. There's a lot of support for the opposition that comes now from the United States, but even more from Gulf states. And most of the international support that comes to one side or the other is intensifying the war already and helping the combatants to continue that. And part of the difficult strategic consequences or situation in which we find ourselves is that if you pretend that this is a war in which the president of Syria is thinking of the insurgency as, in some sense, unified and potentially supported by the United States, then it's hard to come up with a strategic logic for him to use these sorts of nerve agents against his own population. And I've seen some, commentary that says, why would it be in his interest to do so? And it only makes sense if you disaggregate the insurgency and disaggregate the government so that the lesson from Egypt for someone like al-Assad is the principal enemy to his power is probably his own army. And the key to his continuation in office in a rump Syria that involves maybe half of the population of the country is to make sure that there is unity of the party, of the army, of the crony capitalists to maintain his coalition. And unfortunately, one way that he could do that is by implicating the army in war crimes.
Mm. Okay, let's go ahead and get some callers on the line. Our lines are full right now. Let's go ahead and take, I apologize if I mispronounce this, Sida from Albuquerque. Good morning, Sida.
Good morning, this is Sida. I'm part of an ad hoc coalition against the war in Syria that has set up meetings with Senator Udall's office, Senator Heinrich's office, and Congresswoman Lujan Grisham's office. And we're very diverse. We have clergy, including the Archdiocese, labor union activists, veterans, including Iraq veterans and Vietnam veterans, and community groups, including the Peace and Justice Center and the American Friends Service Committee. And we met with Udall's office yesterday before he went into that Senate Intelligence Committee meeting, and we were really happy to see that he voted no. So we're really putting the pressure on with these meetings with our Congress to tell them that the majority of New Mexicans are opposed. And I wanted to say that we think that it's a pretty false idea that the Obama administration has put forth that there's a choice to do nothing or to bomb the Syrians. That's not true. We could be part of negotiating a ceasefire. We could be part of stopping arms from going into Syria. We could be doing humanitarian aid. We could be stopping the manufacturing of chemical weapons. We don't trust that the U.S. government really cares about the Syrian people. There are people in countries all over the world that are in civil wars. There are dictators all over the world. Why Syria, and why is the only option they're offering to do an illegal action? And it's not the job of the U.S. to enforce international laws by itself, by breaking international laws. That does not make any sense. That's hypocritical.
All right.
You can't enforce international law by breaking an international law. It's an illegal action, and our Congress should know that and vote no.
Well, and Saida, we'll have our next guest who will join us in a couple of minutes, Jackie Cabasso, the executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation, will expound on those points. Thank you for joining us. Let's go to our next caller. It's Bill from Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill.
Yes, good morning. Situations like this is proof of how vile and hideous humans are to each other. Thousands of children are killed every year in the Congo, and Syria is no exception. Wars are created by politicians. It's all political. That's what's the matter. Our situation is that the law of 1925 has always been violated, included by America, or Agent Orange, napalm to Cambodia, Vietnam. Situations like that has always happened. We're no exception either. So consider this to be, it's all politics. That's my answer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, Bill. Let's bring in our next caller. It's Simon, who wants to talk about another reason, perhaps, why Syria might be targeted. Go ahead. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning. Yes, I'd like to cite Tom Segeff's book, 1967, which is available in the public library. On page 200, he quotes then-Israeli diplomat Shlomo Argoff, who was later shot in London. Mr. Argoff goes that in 1967, the Israelis were egged on by the British ambassador to Israel to attack Syria. And he said that he thought that this might be a proxy war between the Iraqi petroleum company, at that time BP, and the independence of Syria. I see this as another just grab for the oil and natural gas of Syria. Mr. Argoff was shot in London, and the then Israeli government in 1982 used this pretext to invade Lebanon under the command of Ariel Sharon. But please, page 200 of 1967, the year that changed the Middle East. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, Simon. And we do have our next guest on the line. But before we lose this thread, I'm wondering, Dr. Zunas, if you'd like to make a brief comment to those last two calls.
Oh, just that the Syria has been in the crosshairs of some elements in the foreign policy establishment in this country for quite a few years. Syria has been singled out for sanctions for engaging in activities that other countries in the region have been doing as well. But, for example, their sanctions imposed in 2003 in part because of Syria's refusal to get rid of their chemical weapons, but nothing about Israel getting rid of its chemical weapons or Egypt getting rid of its chemical weapons. In fact, Syria in 2007, when it had a non-permanent seat in the United Nations, called for a regional disarmament regime where all the countries would have to get rid of their weapons of mass destruction in the region, which is a follow-up, actually, to UN Security Council Resolution 687, the Iraq disarmament resolution. But the United States blocked it with our veto power. Because our view is that our allies can get away with certain things that governments who don't like Syria. Similarly, in 1960, that same year, the Israeli Assad sued for peace with the Israelis. He said, "You give us back the Golan Heights, Syrian. Everybody recognizes the Syrian territory that Israel's occupied since 1967, and in return, we'll have full diplomatic and economic relations. We'll demilitarize the Golan, bring in international peacekeeping forces, whatever security guarantees you want." And the Israeli cabinet was considering it, and the Bush administration pressured the Israelis not to do it.
So,
didn't want a political victory for Assad. And so, in other words, I think given this history, that's why I think an attack on Syria, even in response to this horrific attack, is going to just play right into the hands of saying, hey, this is not about chemical weapons. This is about American imperialism and hegemony.
Mm. Well, thank you for that. And joining us by phone now is our next guest, Jacqueline Cabasso, the executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation in Oakland, California. Welcome, and thank you for joining us by telephone.
Thank you.
Jackie, many have heard, we've even heard it expressed today, that a military strike against Syria would be illegal under international law. Is that so? And if so, why?
It is actually a black and white case at this point. The United Nations Charter is the highest treaty in the world, and it is binding law on the United States. And under the United Nations Charter, states are required to try every peaceful means possible to resolve disputes before resorting to force. And then, if they are going to resort to force, they must have the approval of the United Nations Security Council. The only other provision for the use of force is in cases of self-defense, which are very carefully specified. But the situation in Syria does not meet either of those criteria, and therefore a unilateral military attack by the U.S. against Syria is illegal.
You know, I read that the U.N. Chemical Weapons Inspection Team took samples, and yesterday they reached the designated laboratories for testing. And the sole mandate of the U.N. right now is to find out if chemical weapons were used, and if so, what? Not who used it against whom. So there's a process that's being followed here. Are people upset with the timetable of that process?
Well, when you say people.
Yeah, well, go ahead. We could parse them out.
What do you
yes.
mean? Yeah.
Well, okay, choose one.
Well, let me take that in a slightly different direction.
Please do.
Let me take it, what should be done, what could be done as an alternative to doing nothing,
please
which
do.
Is a false alternative which is being presented to us by President Obama. The United Nations Security Council could do a lot of things other than authorizing the use of force. The probably the most urgent thing that they should do now, with the U.S. and Russian support, would be to condemn the use of chemical weapons by any party, to extend and expand the mandate of the U.N. inspectors, to give them the authority not only to investigate and collect evidence, but also to determine the responsible parties. And the Security Council could simultaneously refer the case to the International Criminal Court for investigation. Under those conditions, the International Criminal Court would have the authority to investigate and to bring the responsible parties to justice.
Now,
so that's one chain of possible action that could be taken.
Now, the Senate resolution that was passed yesterday gives Obama 60 days to act, with the option of extending the action for another 30 days. Could that chain of action that you described, could that fit within that timetable?
I don't really know, but the sooner it gets started, the sooner it could be effective. There are other things that could happen, though, and certainly within that time frame. For example, the 189 countries are parties to the Chemical Weapons Convention, which prohibits the production, acquisition, stockpiling, or use of chemical weapons. So it's nearly universal. Syria is not a party, but under the under customary international law, a prohibition with that much support is considered to be universal, and that's recognized by the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is the guardian of international law. The Chemical Weapons Convention could convene an emergency meeting of all of its parties or of its executive council, and could make recommendations to the UN, or could refer the situation to the International Court of Justice, which is another international judicial body in The Hague. And interestingly, and I don't hear anybody really talking about this, the G20 are meeting starting today in Russia. The G20 include, that's the group of 20 of the world's leading economic powers, representing about 85% of the world's economies. All five permanent members of the Security Council are present there. All but three of the countries represented there are on the currently elected members of the Executive Committee of the Chemical Weapons Convention. So we have been hearing reports that there will be discussions about the Syrian situation on the margins of the G20 meeting, but it seems like a very good opportunity for the Executive Committee of the the Chemical Weapons Convention to have some discussions about convening an emergency meeting.
All right. We're talking about Syria today and the chemical weapons attacks that took place. There are several ways for you to participate in this discussion. You may email your comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may call our local number, 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. Or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. Where have you gone to uncover the truth about what happened in Syria? When we return from a short break, we'll get to our callers.
So far, Changing Worlds, the campaign for UNM, has brought together over 50,000 generous donors with promising students, exceptional patient care and treatment, and renowned faculty throughout the many programs of the University of New Mexico. Donors take pride in connecting with the exceptional, investing in the future, and inspiring others to do the same. Learn more at FromHereWorldsChange.org, a message from the tax-exempt UNM Foundation.
On the next American Radio Works documentary,
no two kids learn at the same pace.
Teachers struggle to give every student what they need. Some say computers can help.
I can have 30 different assignments if I wanted to.
Others are more skeptical.
We're still talking about what's essentially an experiment.
Listen for One Child at a Time, Custom Learning in the Digital Age, from APM, American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
Good morning and welcome back to the KUNM Collins Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and joining me to discuss Syria is the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, a political science professor at UNM, Dr. Mark Pisani. Joining me by phone is Dr. Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the Middle Eastern Studies Program, and Jackie Cabasso, executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation. Let's go to Carol from Albuquerque. Carol, good morning. Thank you for joining our discussion.
Yes, and thank you for having this discussion. I would like to speak to the question of unanticipated consequences and using World War I as a brief example. The assassination of the Archduke on June 28, 1914 was the great crime of those years because you had crowned heads in Europe, and this was before there was poison gas. But to kill a member of the aristocracy, an heir to the throne, was a great crime. So the Austrians threatened the Serbians, who had done it, and then the Russians came in to support the Serbians, and the Germans came after to support the Austrians and declared war on Russia, and then attacked France. And then in attacking France, they went through Belgium, which was the key for bringing in the English. The English declared war on Germany, and you had all of Europe against each other's throats over the assassination of one man.
So,
and
what,
in the end, there were over 10 million soldiers who died because of the death of this Archduke. And my feeling is that history tends to take on its own momentum and its own brutality. And once the thing starts, then it's extremely difficult to stop it.
All right. Thank you so much for pointing us to remember those events, Carol. Let's go ahead and bring in our next caller. It's Miles. Miles from Santa Fe. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely. Please go ahead.
Great. One of the there's plenty of humanitarian arguments that can be made for intervention in Syria, but one of the arguments that President Obama made was that Syria is the owner of the largest stockpiles of chemical weapons on the planet, and because of the Assad regime's alliance with Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda and Iran, that poses a threat to the United States. I can certainly understand that. And a destabilized Assad regime could certainly lead to those weapons being in the hands of people that don't like us. But I haven't heard anyone talk about targeting those stockpiles in any sort of strike. That would be a compelling argument, but I really haven't heard that made. Did your panel talk about that?
All right, let's go ahead. Jackie Cabasso, let's go to you first on that issue.
I just couldn't hear the very last thing that the caller said.
He hadn't heard about directly targeting stockpiled weapons, and he wanted the panel to address that. He wondered if we were looking to strike stockpiled weapons that could be used against us.
Well, we've heard speculation about various sets of potential targets. It would be extremely dangerous to target the stockpiles. I mean, that just goes without saying. I want to say that the United States cannot make the argument that it is facing an imminent threat from serious chemical weapons based on what has happened. That just does not meet the legal test. So that still does not authorize U.S. U.S. military force. I did read a very interesting article, however, suggesting that Iran might be actually in a position to help bring about a diplomatic solution because of its own horrendous experience as a victim of chemical weapons 25 years ago, which, by the way, the United States may have been complicit in. And this article went on to speculate about the possibility of ultimately arranging a situation in which serious chemical stocks were transferred to a third party under international control, that third party potentially being Russia. So the chemical weapons stocks need to be dealt with. Chemical weapons need to be, banned, abolished, never used again by anybody. That's not the question. There should be universal condemnation of the use of chemical weapons. But the solution is not U.S. unilateral military strikes, which I think, without going into the details, the previous caller raising the specter of World War One gives us something to think about, because there are so many states parties and non-states parties in the region. The politics are so complicated. The conflicts are so deep. It's really a tinderbox, and it would be like throwing a match on gasoline, even though that's a cliche phrase. I mean, it's as good as any to describe the situation.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Zunis, would you care to respond to the caller?
Yeah, certainly bombing stockpiles would be a bad idea because it would release all these chemical agents into the air. And there is some evidence that the Assad regime has deliberately placed some of its stockpiles in crowded civilian areas. And similarly, the chemical weapons can be delivered by all sorts of means, planes, helicopters, missiles, mortars. So there's no realistic scenario of destroying the delivery systems either. And again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that I can't think of a practical or tactical or strategic argument in favor of an attack. But on the broader question, in addition to what I raised earlier about the United States not being very good at supporting a more universal approach to disarmament of these deadly weapons, the very fact that though I personally believe that the Syrian government was indeed responsible for the attacks on August 21st, the very fact that you had top U.S. officials, not just the Bush administration, but John Kerry and Joe Biden as senators, and Nancy Pelosi as well, saying categorically that Iraq had chemical weapons and that they were a danger to the national security of the United States. For them to be saying, making the same kind of line now, you can kind of understand why a lot of people are skeptical, why a lot of people are thinking about, given all these conspiracy theories and that kind of thing. And that's another reason why I don't think the United States has the moral authority to take leadership on this. I mean, this is a crisis. This does deserve an international response. But when you are dealing with something like this, you can't have a country with a record like the United States taking the lead, especially this idea that, in order to punish this violation of international law, we have to violate international law ourselves by engaging in illegal military action.
Mark Pisani, I've certainly seen images. I can't imagine I'm the only one, of refugees now streaming out of Syria, a country that was already housing numerous refugees from other conflicts. How should that issue figure into our thinking about Syria?
Well, I think a million Syrians have already left because of the civil war. And if more people are leaving now, is it because they fear a U.S. strike or because... And again, I don't have the latest intelligence information. I understand skepticism, but there's good reason to believe that the Syrian government used these agents in populated suburbs of Damascus. And that could be another reason why people are leaving. I'd like to go back to the World War One analogy
for a moment.
Please do. And that is, and to place this in the political context of the United States, I'm actually not terribly concerned that we could have this be the first step towards another, global war, in part because the context of the Syrian conversation today is very much like the context of the decisions about interventions after the Vietnam War. Whereas, you know, the Iraq War came in the wake of 9/11. The Syrian war comes in the wake of the Iraq War. And in a lot of ways, I see Obama's responses to this particular war and to a variety of similar circumstances to have much more in common with the Eisenhower administration or the Reagan administration, a reluctance to engage in large-scale direct combat and a preference for covert proxy war and for offshore attacks from cruise missiles,
right,
or airstrikes. And so even if the Congress says yes, they're likely to say yes with more restrictions than Obama asked for. And that would be in keeping with his pattern of preferring drone strikes and supporting, you know, others in their fights rather than to get U.S. troops on the ground in a large-scale war. So I don't see escalation in a World War I scenario to be particularly likely. But I think that whether or not there are airstrikes now, the best estimate is that you're likely to get a combination of airstrikes and increased support for the insurgents that are more likely to be at least open to conversation with the United States. And there are some that are less likely. Mm-hmm. But to go back to, you know, what may be a best case scenario for Assad would be to combine a severing of possibilities of conversation between the army and the elements of the Free Syrian Army that are former soldiers, former Baathists, many of whom are concentrated in the suburbs around Damascus. So it widens the gap between them, and then an ineffectual U.S. strike would reinforce that, because then it would say to people within Assad's government that the United States is no longer at least even possible as an ally, if not an ally, to make some sort of deal. So the most likely scenario for a negotiated settlement is for elements of the Assad regime to sever their ties with the dictator and to come to some understanding with the less extreme elements of the insurgency. And everything that Assad has done in the last couple of weeks, and many of the things that the United States is likely to do in the next couple of weeks, make that less possible.
Less possible.
Make it less likely. So that's the principal unintended consequence, that this could reinforce Assad's, you know, hold on power, because it reinforces the solidity of his coalition. And this war could go on endlessly, because if Assad was going to be defeated, it probably would have happened by now. And he's consolidated enough authority in enough areas of Syria that he could keep doing this for a long time. And the insurgents are gaining in resources and power. And they could think that if they stick to it long enough, they'll win. So, you know, Stephen Zunis was right in saying that if the U.S. intervenes, especially the ways that are being considered now, there's a good chance that it intensifies the conflict, that it leads to more death, at least to a longer war. But the problem is, if the United States engages in international diplomacy or chooses to take a step back, you know, you still may have stalemate and you still may have escalation.
Complex issue. Let's go ahead and bring in our next caller, Bob from Albuquerque, who is opposed to the U.S. willingness to be involved. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Thanks for having the program. I really appreciate it. I just have a brief comment. As a citizen of the United States and a voter, I would really like to see, and I have no confidence that it will happen, the United States for once take a lead and demonstrate the capacity to act like a mature individual would, to use the legal systems and to deal with people who misbehave and break laws, rather than coming in with a big bully club and just making everybody around the world continue to hate us. That's my comment.
Well, let me ask you a question, Bob. Do you think the stepping back by President Obama and going to Congress is a sign of maturity, in your words?
I like to see things slow down. You know, we're talking about doing something really significant and important, and it seems like what we typically do is race in without proper information and without, you know, getting the cooperation of people around the world, and it just makes us look like fools, I think.
Okay. Bob, thanks so much for your call this morning. Let's go ahead and bring in Don from Albuquerque, who wants to talk about the lack of U.S. moral authority in his mind. Go ahead, Don. You're with us.
The U.S. has no moral authority to demand Syria to stop using chemical weapons because U.S. mutilated and murdered many thousands of women and children with napalm and Agent Orange in Vietnam, white phosphorus and depleted uranium in Iraq, drones in Pakistan and Afghanistan, atom bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The U.S. is the only nation in human history who used atom bombs on cities of people. The U.S. stands guilty of monstrous hypocrisy and massive atrocities.
Don, thank you for your call. As a way of wrapping up, as we're nearing the end, let's go ahead and get our panelists to address that issue. Jackie Cabasso, you want to weigh in on the U.S.'s moral authority in this instant?
Well, having spent the last 30 years devoting my life to the elimination of nuclear weapons, I completely agree with what the last caller said, and I'm glad that he said it, given that we are speaking to you in New Mexico, where the Los Alamos National Lab is continuing to modernize U.S. nuclear weapons. I do want to say, though, regarding the unintended consequences, I don't think that the last speakers considered fully the unintended consequences that may result from other actors, not the United States. I think that Russia, it plays an incredibly significant role in this situation and actually could hold the keys to a diplomatic solution if the U.S. were more open to it. The U.S. and Russia started talking about a Syrian peace process that was derailed in large part by the United States. That really must get back on track. Russia and Iran are supplying the Syrian government. Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia are supplying some of the rebels. The United States, CIA is training insurgents and so on and so forth. We have all kinds of parties in the region. We don't know how Israel would react. We don't know how Iran would react. We don't know how Russia would react. So I really do think that the unintended consequences go far beyond what were, or the potential unintended consequences go far beyond what were stated and really could spiral out of control.
All right. And Mark Piscina, you want to weigh in Jackie's thoughts about perhaps unintended consequences that weren't mentioned?
Well, it is an incredibly complex situation. So it is really hard to predict what will happen.
Yeah. Dr. Zunis, so thoughts would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, it's very, very difficult to, you know, calibrate a, first of all, history is replete with examples of so-called limited military actions that end up dramatically escalating. I mean, even groups like the International Crisis Group, you know, which are very very mainstream, and made up of leading analysts from governments around the world. You know, they raise this concern. I mean, I guess it's possible to calibrate an attack, and theoretically possible to calibrate an attack where it does enough damage to force Syrians to compromise, but not so much that escalates or leads to retaliation. But that's very hard to find, and the odds of getting that are not. Non-existent, but I would say pretty slim.
All right. Well, we'll all be watching this situation and looking for all of you. Thanks to our guest, Western States Legal Foundation Executive Director Jacqueline Cabasso, University of San Francisco Professor Stephen Zunis, and Mark Piscina, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UNM, for making themselves available to our listeners. Thank you all. And thanks to our callers for helping to develop our discussion today. Thanks to our engineer, Ramon Garcia, our assistant engineer, Jeff White. Steve Emmons is our assistant producer. Andy Lyman has handled our phones today. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Kathleen Sabo. This has been the KUNM Call-In Show on KUNM, news and music that connect from the University of New Mexico.